This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And once again, here on New England Lifestyles on Radio.com in Boston, Mike Mullaney. You know, we talked about the election, and joining me on the phone, by the way, is Bridgewater State University's Dr. Brian Frederick, who has been our, you know, we've had so many conversations this year, Brian. It is good to talk to you again, and here we are, post-election. Don't have all the answers yet, but certainly, what an interesting election season we just saw.
It certainly was. It's not too often that we don't know who the winner of the presidential contest is going to be the morning after the previous day's election. And we'll throw in 2020 to that list of times where we didn't have a winner initially known to us. Last time we were in that circumstance was the year 2000. So. Yeah. It's not unprecedented, but it's not the most usual set of circumstances either.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, as we watch, and look, if you live to be 100 years old, you only have 25 of those election nights in your life, you know what I mean? So they're pretty rare. And, you know, it's for guys like you and me, I'm sure you sat there, grabbed your popcorn, sat down and just watched. And, you know, it's an interesting thing the way this year played out. So many things contributed to what we saw, including the way it took so long for this election to be, you know, it's still not official. And no matter what happens, it's still going to take a little bit of time. But, you know, so many different factors, you know, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw, you know, early voting and, mail-in ballots and stuff. And this had a huge impact on the election, especially the way it played out. You know, as we sat there, you know, Tuesday night, it appeared as we watched the returns that we were going to see Donald Trump reelected, but it didn't play out that way.
That is correct. Pandemic was the major force in shaping what happened in this election cycle. So on the question of who voted and how they voted, obviously we would not have had as many mail-in ballots if it wasn't for COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of people felt, particularly Democrats, that it was not safe to go vote in person. And so that's why we see a lot of states conducting heavy mail-in ballots in ways that they hadn't before. There are some states that do all their elections by mail, Oregon, for instance, but they have a lot of experience. And typically the elections, particularly presidential elections in that state, haven't been very close. So, you know, you didn't really make that much of it when, you know, all the votes didn't come in at once. But for states like Pennsylvania, it's a new experience to have that many ballots come in. And so it took a little bit longer than usual. And we had this disparity with Election Day voters where Republicans did very well. And most of those votes were being counted earlier. So we saw that the president was looking like he was in good shape, but in some ways that was a red mirage as more and more of the mail-in ballots were coming in. Democrats were emphasizing that approach to casting ballots, and ultimately the leads that the president had in some of these swing states have now evaporated to the point where it looks likely that Joe Biden is going to become president. And as you mentioned, too, the COVID shaped the race in the sense that it was a very close election. And I think if COVID didn't happen, if we didn't have this pandemic, I think based on the close results that we saw Tuesday night, Donald Trump, had that not happened, probably would be looking at a pretty solid reelection at this point.
Yeah, I mean,
that was the major blow to his campaign.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, so much of you talk in January. I was like, you know, whether you like him or not, this guy is probably has done nothing which is going to cause people to radically jump ship. And then, you know, COVID shows up the way he handled it. Some people look at it questionably. The economy goes down. Millions of jobs are lost. The domino effect of what happened with the global pandemic really created. And the Black Lives Matter thing happened. So many things factored in. And, I mean, we'll talk a lot about them, but ultimately, you saw an election which, well, first off, let's talk about the polls. The fact that polling tended to be so crazy. I mean, at first people were saying it was completely out of whack. You know, I know that Nate Silver from 538 came out Friday and said, when this eventually plays out, you'll see that my numbers were actually pretty accurate, because we were saying how out of whack they were. But, you know, it is so difficult sometimes to look at polls. For many, many years, we looked at them as gospel, but we're really starting to see now that there's really no way to predict what will happen.
Well, I think that we probably I would put it a slightly different way. So yes, clearly there were a number of polls that had very large error terms in terms of forecasting what was going to happen in this particular election cycle. So I think there's a couple of different issues there. First of all, the unique nature of Donald Trump and how controversial he is. There are many people in society who don't feel that they can be candid about their support for the president. And so I think that did contribute to what some have called a shy Trump factor. In political science, we call it a social desirability factor, meaning you don't want to be perceived by the person interviewing you as having some view or some thought that might be socially inappropriate. And for many people, supporting Donald Trump is associated with a lot of negative characteristics and attributes. And so that created an issue. And then it's always a difficult to know what the population is that you're taking your sample from. So we have a population out there. Typically, we know what that population is if it's not an election, right? But an election is a moving target where we don't know exactly how many people are going to come out to the polls. And so we take a sample and from a population that is smaller or larger than the expected population come election day, that can produce a result that is also off. And so I think both of those things happened in this particular case. I think it does raise questions for these polling organizations that if they want to credibly poll elections, that they need to take stock of and try to address moving forward. Maybe the fact that we won't have somebody as controversial as President Trump on the ballot, whatever happens in 2024, will make that process a little bit easier. But clearly, there may be some fundamental long-term issues here where some Republican voters just don't feel comfortable either participating or expressing their views in polls. And so, yes, the polling industry took a hit. That doesn't mean that we should totally discard the enterprise of polling, because it is necessary in a democracy to understand how people feel. Elections can do that, but we also need in the middle of elections to understand what people are thinking about public policy so they can send their messages about their preferences to the people. And hopefully these organizations will do a major autopsy and try to overhaul their methodology to produce better results in the future.
You know, and again, when we watched this election play out, it really, there's never been an election with more people voting. Now, obviously, the population of the United States raises, so technically you should be able to get the highest numbers each year. Not always the case. Obviously, in a race contested like this one, you would expect great turnout. And the numbers of people who came out and the number of participation in some of these states was really overwhelming. I mean, is this something that surprises you? Even as a political scientist, you know, you expect to get 60-70%, but you saw even bigger than that across the country, huge turnout. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, to some degree it was surprising. In some ways it wasn't. I mean, this election was all about Donald Trump. Joe Biden inspired no enthusiasm or no great opposition. Actually, he had a net favorable rating last time when compared to Hillary Clinton. She had a net unfavorable rating. More people viewed her unfavorably than favorably. But to the degree that people viewed Biden favorably, it was you know, very marginal, mild. It wasn't about him. This election was all about how you felt about Donald Trump. His supporters were very loyal, thought that he had done a great job, felt like they owed it to the president to get out there and show their support. On the other side, Trump has antagonized the opposition, I think, unlike any other president in history. Obama and Bush certainly had their detractors and critics, but not to the same extent, not to the same level of passion that Trump ignites that opposition. So typically when you see turnout, there's something about both candidates that is going to either bring people to the polls to support them or oppose them. But nothing about Joe Biden was doing that. He was riding on all anti-Trump momentum, really, to get his support. And Trump supporters were they were certainly motivated in 2016 to be against Hillary Clinton, but they didn't have the same sort of fuel in an anti-Joe Biden direction that they did previously. So to the degree that both candidates weren't engendering the enthusiasm and it was one candidate who was doing it, I think that was sort of what made it unique in terms of the turnout.
Yeah, and look, you know, when it comes down to it, the low expectations of Biden's performances, when it came to the actual debates and stuff like that, I think a lot of people were surprised, you know, because a lot of people expected a guy who couldn't, you know, put together a satiation, you know, thought, because he had been described by so many people as, you know, dealing with, you know, mental degradation. But I thought in the grand scheme of things, he ended up handling himself reasonably well, and especially in the days after the election. It's interesting how people really comport themselves. You know, President Trump coming out and making unfounded accusations, declaring himself the winner of Pennsylvania, saying it was stolen from him, talking about voter fraud, which has at this stage of the game been unproven and no evidence was presented, versus Biden, who kept coming out and acting presidential. There's a lot to be said for how people really express themselves. It didn't surprise me the way that came out. Do you think it surprised you in any way?
I don't think so. I think Biden was pretty confident that he was going to win. If he saw the numbers and they weren't looking as good as they were, perhaps he wouldn't have been as magnanimous. He might have been more aggressive and taken a posture that we may need to scrutinize the process more thoroughly. But he generally would have been within the traditional confines of what, say, the Washington consensus finds is appropriate for these kinds of statements, even whether he was winning or losing. So that didn't surprise me. And it didn't surprise me that President Trump was calling into question the integrity of the election. He had been doing that the entire year and questioning the advisability of using mail-in ballots. And he was even more aggressive on Thursday when he gave his statement in raising those questions because the vote margins had turned against him. He was pretty bold in making those claims earlier, but he was a little less provocative in the statements he made about the integrity of the election. But on Thursday, he definitely raised those. I think in terms of how you view it as being presidential, his supporters like him because he does that, that they want to see him go out there and question it. They do not have faith in the system. And so their idea of a president and why they like him and why he inspired so many people is because that's how he comports himself. To the degree that people don't like Trump and voted for Biden, once again, they see Biden maybe not as inspirational, but he operates within what used to be the normal confines of the political system and how you react to an election. And so people see that as presidential. So I think your view on what is considered presidential is also colored by which candidate you support.
Now, I agree. And it was an interesting thing to watch because, you know, one of the things I think is going to be really, you know, not surprising, but telling, you know, when Trump got into the race in 2016, clearly the Republican establishment wanted no part of Donald Trump in their ranks. They did everything they could to undercut him. They did everything they could to try to present a different candidate, but he ended up being the guy and he won the election. Now he is expecting, you know, the Republican Party to stand behind him. And do you think this will be you know, and we'll, you know, by the time this airs this weekend, we may have some of the answers. But he's not the type of guy who the Republican Party is going to stand with overall, do you think? Or is this somewhat, you know, because when it comes down to it, certainly he had popularity, but he was also so, you know, he created such passion on both sides. How do you think the Republican Party looks at him moving ahead?
So I think you're correct that during the primary in 2016, obviously the Republican Party establishment was reluctant to embrace him. They couldn't rally around an opponent that could beat him. And then ultimately in the general election, they kind of gave him lukewarm support, but he ended up winning, I think, to the surprise of most of those Republican leaders. And then once he became president, though, the Republican Party did rally behind him. Lindsey Graham, who was one of his staunchest critics in the primary process, has been one of his most stalwart defenders over the past 4 years, and is actually contributing $500,000 to Trump's legal fund to pose legal challenges to the results. And so the Republican Party, I think, will be behind Trump for a little while. So I think they will allow Trump to go ahead with a recount process, to move forward with any litigation he thinks is necessary. But ultimately, there isn't much of a path for either of those processes to be successful in a way that would allow him to get to the 270 electoral votes that he needs. And so at least by September, the states are going to report those electoral vote counts. And at that point, the Republican leaders may not, they may do it in a delicate, polite fashion, but they're going to say that the people have spoken. Maybe there were questions about the election. We'll move forward and try to fix those. But President Trump will have to accept the result as much as he doesn't like it. And so they will stay with him until the process is finalized and it shows that he is not the winner. They're not going to take the public relations hit to try to see a president not accept the result and refuse to concede to his opponent when it is clear that he has lost. So the short answer is they'll stick with him a little while longer, but once he's clearly lost the power, they're going to move on and face the reality that they have to confront a Biden administration.
And again, we're talking to Dr. Brian Frederick, who is the this chair of the Bridgewater State University Political Science Department. And, you know, we're just talking about this election. And there were a couple of things that really stood out. You know, so much of the conversation leading into the election was, the Electoral College is going to go. This is antiquated. But I really think the Electoral College showed its strength here because, you know, if it's just a popular vote, the popular vote, it's over, and you know Biden wins by 4 million. But the integrity of having states, you know, it's not one election; it's 50 individual state elections, and plus the District of Columbia and whoever else. The idea, and we saw how this played out. Every year, a different player is involved. Some years it's the same. This year, Georgia became the epicenter of the political universe. And how do you think this illustrated the strength or weakness, from your perspective, of the Electoral College?
I think you have to look at it in terms of how do the American people feel about the Electoral College. In poll after poll, clear majorities of the American people say they believe that the popular vote, the candidate who receives the most votes on a nationwide basis, should be the candidate who wins. So we could have had a situation where, once again, for the third time this century, just a few votes flip in some of these states, where the candidate who did not receive the most votes in a national election did not end up winning. And so I think that that would have raised severe questions about the legitimacy of American democracy. Can you call yourself even a democratic republic if the candidate for the most powerful office in your country doesn't have the most popular support in an election? Now, the defenders of the Electoral College, obviously, which you are one, will point out that, hey, it's the states that determine who is going to be the president, and that the founders did not explicitly want the popular vote to be the mechanism by which we select the president. So I think it really depends on whether you believe that people should decide the election or whether you believe that states should decide elections. If you're in favor of the Electoral College, then you probably look at it and do see that this validates your view. If you believe that the popular vote is the way, you look at it and say, well, we just dodged a bullet where we had a candidate who did win the popular vote and the Electoral College when we almost had the opposite result happened two election cycles in a row and to the third time in this century. So I think it comes down to how you feel about whether the Electoral College is a good way to elect a president. No other country does it like we do it. We would never advise another country to set up a process modeled off the Electoral College to select their president. But we've maintained it because, for the most part, it would require a constitutional amendment to change. And given the polarized nature of American politics, constitutional amendments are almost impossible to pass. So it's going to be with us for many years to come, whether we like it or not.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think would be the result if we went to a straight popular vote? How much do you think the dynamic would change? How much do you think, you know, the voices of California, New York, Florida, and Texas would really kind of determine the strength of the country?
Well, it would be the entire country voting as a single voting block. So now we have a situation where it's the voters in swing states that only get to see the candidate. Your state has to be electorally competitive for that candidate to visit and to run ads and engage with voters. We here in Massachusetts are going to be shut out under that system because the Democratic candidate pretty much always wins. If you're in Oklahoma, there aren't many candidates that are coming down there to campaign because the Republican is going to win. So right now we have a situation where voters in swing states exert more power than the rest of us do, where we have larger population centers. The principle of a political equality says that every individual's vote should count the same. Under our present system, it doesn't count the same. Under a system where the popular vote determined who the president was, everybody's vote would be equal. And so you have to decide, do you think that we should try to limit the power of certain states because they have larger populations, or do you believe that it's more important for each citizen to have an equal say in who their president is? I think that's where the debate around the Electoral College is centered. And so right now, because our system does give smaller states greater ability to have representation than their numbers would suggest they should, they have the ability to impose a veto in getting rid of the Electoral College, even though clear majorities of the American people have consistently said they would like to move to a popular vote system.
It really is interesting to see because, you know, as you look at the population of the United States and you look at where the votes came from, you know, if you put it over by county, it's so overwhelmingly red in this country versus the blue counties. But when it comes down to it, those counties that are blue tend to be more educated and tend to be far, far more populated. So it's one of those interesting debates that everyone can always take either side on. The one of the things that has been presented, and you know, it's interesting, is that you know, President Trump said he would go to the Supreme Court to fight this. In order to get to the Supreme Court to decide elections like this, and we mentioned the fact that there's a couple of different options where it actually can go to a state vote on the election, but when it comes down to it, one of the things is that you just can't say, I'm going to the Supreme Court. You need solid evidence. And I know that in Michigan, one of the things that they presented to the court there for a reason to put a halt to the election was a post-it note saying, I'm feeling pressured. And you need more than that. In order to get something to the Supreme Court, you really need to see something that happened, like in Florida, where hanging chads caused huge amounts of consternation, and we still don't know whether or not that was adjudicated the right way, but the Supreme Court in Florida ruled that way, or the Supreme Court ruled Florida that way. Your thoughts on whether, you know, how something gets there and why this year probably is not going to be the case unless something big changes?
Yeah, I think you have to have the ability to show that votes either should have been counted that were not, or votes that were counted shouldn't have been counted under the law. And you also have to show that in a particular state that would have an impact on the margin such that it would flip the state back from Biden to Trump. And so that requires a lot of evidence, much more evidence than what we've seen so far produced by the Trump campaign. Now, they may have evidence that we haven't seen, and they may roll into court with lawsuits and be able to demonstrate and document irregularities that overwhelm the vote margins in the states that they trail, and be able to cite specific statutes that were violated, be able to cite specific votes that were tabulated in error. But the margins we're talking about are nothing, are not, even though they are percentage wise very close, 1 or 2% in terms of raw numbers of votes. Now we're getting into the thousands. In Florida in 2000, it was just around 500 votes and it was one state. So the ability of the Trump campaign to produce a lawsuit that would go all the way up through the court system to the Supreme Court, where they would feel compelled to rule, is very slim, because it's not, we're not just dealing with one state like we did in Florida. Trump is behind in multiple states that he needs to make up in order to get the 270. And you can't just say we're taking a case to the Supreme Court. As you said, you've got to have a body of evidence that suggests that vote is not accurate, and that that case could reverse the decision. And I haven't seen that coming from the Trump campaign.
Yeah, neither have we. One of the things that really fascinated me was a state like Georgia, which is traditionally a very red state, ended up flipping. And unless things change over the next couple of days, before we air this, that is a huge story. And a lot of people are pointing to, Stacey Abrams and her, what happened in Georgia. Georgia's been a real spot for a lot of political upheaval, and there are a few things like that that happen across the country. Arizona has been traditionally a state that's mostly red, but a lot of people are saying that Trump's absolute disrespect towards John McCain had a role in that. Sometimes there are these little stories, well, not necessarily little, but not necessarily national stories, which can have big impact on elections. What do you think some of those things were?
Yeah, so when we come to Georgia, I think actually it's not so much the work that Stacey Abrams did, because Trump actually increased his support among African Americans, particularly African American males. He saw an increase. Where Trump lost ground is in the suburbs among highly educated white voters in Georgia, who had in recent elections supported the Republican Party, but found Trump's, I think, persona and some of the way he conducted himself objectionable. So those voters flipped along with the solid base of increasing numbers of voters of color who supported the Democrats. And so that allowed Biden to just get over the hump, it appears, and win Georgia. As far as Arizona goes, I don't really put much stock in the McCain phenomenon. Trump won overwhelmingly with Republicans in Arizona. I think COVID is what hurt him in Arizona. The spikes that you saw at several points in this year, and the elderly leaning population, who I think were not impressed with President Trump's response to COVID. Not so much that they blamed him totally for it, but that he could have handled the response better. So I would look at that issue as opposed to anything he said about McCain, because he said those same things about McCain in 2016 and won the state. That didn't change. What did change was the fact that there was a pandemic that I think led some, particularly elderly voters, to say that they weren't going to vote Trump this time because they were disappointed in his performance.
And again, we're talking to Dr. Brian Frederick from Bridgewater State University, my alma mater, go Bears. So my question now is, Trump, being his age and everything like that, the cult of personality is definitely on his side. Do you think he has a political future? Do you think he can still stick around and get a nomination in 4 years? Because, again, you look at the amount of votes he pulled, more than any other candidate in the history of the United States outside of Joe Biden this time around. What do you think his political future is, and how do you see that whole thing playing out?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether Trump at his age in 2024 would want to run again. Obviously, he demonstrated incredible stamina on the campaign trail.
He really did.
The last few days, making multiple appearances, just as he did in 2016. I think that's why it bears watching how he responds to the possibility that he might have to concede here shortly. Because if the Republicans, yes, if he wants to win the Republican nomination in 2024, there's no Republican that can stand in his way. He's definitely going to win it. But he's also going to think about whether he would want to potentially face another loss in 2024 in a general election. And if voters overall sour on the way that he handles the possible transition with Joe Biden, that could put him in a difficult situation. So if he is thinking about that long term, he might say to himself, as much as he hates to admit it and much as he doesn't like to concede defeat, that very quickly his tone and posture might change in order to preserve a possible run in 2024, where if the Biden presidency doesn't work out and he doesn't turn out to be popular, if President Trump maintains his base and doesn't, I think, do damage in the eyes of voters that could flip either way between him and Biden, that he could be positioned in 2024 to run again. I have no inside information into the Trump campaign or any inside information on how Donald Trump is thinking about it. But I think if he did want to run again in 2024, certainly he'd be the leading contender in the Republican Party.
It certainly is amazing to see the force of personality, you know, like him or hate him. It's just one of those things where not many people have the type of personality that engenders such passion one way or the other. And that's something that's rare in politicians and something that, you know, you see why people win elections and why some don't. You know, that having that amount of charisma one way or the other is a huge factor. Let me ask
you. And I think
finish up. I had another question. So go ahead. Finish up.
I was just going to say, and I think that's something that the Democratic Party needs to reevaluate. They've underestimated the strength of Trump in the past couple of election cycles, and they've had such a negative view of him that I think it has clouded some of the political attributes that he does have that are appealing, that they are overlooking and need to address, because the Democratic Party underperformed relative to expectations.
Yeah.
Why is that? And why did they underestimate Trump in both 2016 and 2020? And that is something they need to ponder moving forward.
Well, the last question I have is, you know, we have two runoffs happening in Georgia. There is still a chance that the Democrats could grab the Senate. That would be it would be fascinating to see where we were Tuesday night at around 11 p.m. and where it could end up. I mean, what do you think the odds there are?
Yeah, so these Georgia Senate runoffs are not uncommon. We saw one in 1992 where incumbent Democrat White Fowler ended up losing to Paul Coverdale, who was a Republican. In 2008, after Obama had won, there was a Senate runoff that the Republicans also won. So traditionally, Republicans have been much better at turning out their voters in these runoff elections. The Democrats haven't done that well. Maybe they've solved that runoff puzzle. So the Perdue was running a couple percentage points ahead. He'll probably start out as a favorite. Loeffler was in a multi-candidate race because of this. It was filling a vacant seat. It wasn't, it wasn't a regular election. So she might have a tougher race. But the Democrats have to win both, and if they do, they will have 50 senators with Vice President Kamala Harris breaking the tie. That technically means the Democrats control the Senate and they control the agenda, but the Republicans only need one defector, like Senator Joe Manchin, for instance, of West Virginia, to say, no, I'm not going to be in favor of increasing the size of the Supreme Court, or I'm not in favor of making D.C. a state, or I'm not in favor of repealing the Bush tax cuts, so that the Democratic agenda isn't really going to get very far. So I think it's more likely that the Republicans hold on to a majority, but even if they don't, it doesn't really set Biden up in the best position as to succeed. I think the Democrats were hoping they would have 51 or 52, a clear majority, but they failed to unseat Susan Collins, Tom Tillis in North Carolina, Joni Ernst in Iowa, and So clinging to the hope that they'll win both Georgia Senate seats is probably remote at this point, but it's not impossible. And that would help Biden a little bit, but I don't think anybody should be under the illusion that there's going to be monumental change that occurs over the next 4 years, because the Republicans are going to pretty much obstruct almost everything that Biden wants to do from a legislative standpoint. And if the filibuster is in place, meaning that 60 votes is still required for most legislation in the Senate, even under the most favorable terms for the Democrats, it's not going to be an era of major legislative accomplishments. So I think if you're a Republican who's disappointed about Donald Trump losing, at least you can take solace in the fact that Joe Biden has fewer Democratic House members than were expected and fewer Democratic senators than were expected. So he's not going to be able to enact the centerpiece of his agenda. He's probably going to be working more on foreign policy and using executive orders to try to get things done.
Well, I tell you what, you know, it's hopefully, you know, after the amount of adversarial conversations and how split we are, we know that McConnell and Biden have worked together for years. I mean, I don't know if there's any hope of getting a kinder, gentler Congress where maybe we can get stuff done. Fingers crossed, but clearly it's not going to be.
A lot of Democrats in the primary criticized Biden for the 2012 deal that he made with McConnell that basically extended about 90% of the Bush tax cuts. So if Biden is willing to extend the Trump tax cuts, I'm sure that Mitch McConnell would be more than willing to sign on to that deal. I'm not so sure that many Democrats would be happy with him if he did it again. So we'll see what happens. Yeah, they are long-term colleagues, but Joe Biden dealt with Mitch McConnell in a much different era. This is a much more confrontational era, and I don't think that same Mitch McConnell is going to have the same inclination to deal with Biden like he did in the past.
Nah, it's going to be something to watch. Well, again, fascinating season of politics. It's been great catching up with you throughout this year, throughout the process. Again, Dr. Brian Frederick from Bridgewater State University, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for your insight over the past year. And here we go back into, let's see. We don't know anything yet. Until January 20th, nothing's assured. So thank you, my friend.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Here at Radio.com in Boston, New England Lifestyles, I'm Mike Mullaney. What a week. Joining us on the phone to discuss the insanity of the week and a new book that he has written is a frequent guest of mine. His name is Ravi Hathisingh, and he has just written a new book called Pivot, Empowering Students Today to Succeed in an Unpredictable Tomorrow. And I'm hoping you wrote this in the last 6 months, because boy, oh boy, if it wasn't previously, boy, has the world blown up. Ravi, welcome back.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here, as always. Appreciate it.
The book. Did you have any idea when you were talking about unpredictable tomorrow that it would become this unpredictable? What a year. Jeez.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, look, pivot is the word, right? But that everybody's talking about how we have to pivot through COVID, through what's going on with our crazy election, with the economy, everything. And, I started this book a couple of years ago, and I started with the title. So in a sense, yes, I knew that this was going to be something that we need to empower students to be able to do, and that the future is not only unpredictable in the short term, but it's always unpredictable to a large degree. And I was writing and struggling with the book a lot and going different routes. And then COVID hit. And you might remember I was on what was supposed to be a 3-week trip in Chile. I was stranded there for about 6 months.
Which is crazy.
And crazy, but it was great because I was staying with some friends and we were quarantined. And that family included 4 teenagers that were adapting to school as it was transitioning to a home environment. And so I was in the thick of it. And that's what really helped me just say, you know, and now I know exactly what this book needs to be and why it's relevant now.
Now, let me ask you this. Obviously, you're down there in Chile and, you know, your background. For those who don't remember our conversations, Ravi is quite a history. First off, you know, he introduced himself and I found out that he played guitar with Hanson, who's some good friends of mine. So that was pretty wild. But you're also the first American born member of, well, I guess you could call it India's first family. You're related to the Nehrus and Gandhi. So obviously your history is quite interesting. It's international and it's very diverse.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, you know, I grew up in this basically a political family, but my dad didn't want to go into politics. So he immigrated into the United States and he became one of the first Indians to work on Wall Street. And then my two older brothers followed in his footsteps. So it's kind of weird. I had this political family background, but I grew up in a financial investment banking family. And then I discovered the electric guitar, and that was all over for me.
The electric guitar changes the way a lot of people think. You know, it changed my life, too, because, you know, I thought I was going to be a scientist. All of a sudden, I heard music, and for my, you know, I was in a bunch of garage bands, and I realized I had to make my living based on music. Ended up the music director of, you know, three major radio stations in Boston. It's been wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, and the other part of it is you're also a keynote speaker. You're empowering education. You talk to business leaders. You do a lot. And so my question is this. Obviously, your background is international. You were in Chile during the start of this. I need to ask this first because obviously we're watching, you know, what looks like, you know, the end of the Trump administration and, you know, moving in a new direction. You know, obviously this is still up in the air and will be up in the air for a while, but it appears that's the case. Let me ask you this. What is the perspective of the everything that went on in the United States, not only, you know, the COVID reaction, but, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement from the international community about the United States? We're very insulated here in the United States. We're very United States-centric. What is the thought process of those outside the country? I wanted to get that perspective because I think it would be an interesting take.
Yeah, well, you know, while I was really, you know, deep into writing this book, George Floyd was killed, too. So, you know, it was really interesting to be out of the country, but looking into the country while writing about everything from, you know, pivoting because of what was going on with COVID to civil discourse, what was going on with our election, to cultural competence and equality and all the issues that were sort of racism, implicit bias, all those things that were coming up with the killing of George Floyd. So it was this sort of confluence of amazing things that really, you know, fed a lot of my narrative and thoughts in the book and made it very current. But being outside of the country at the time and basically, you know, everybody sort of related to what happened with George Floyd. And that, as I say in the book, you know, the protests and rise of the millennial generation and Gen Z for social justice, it traversed borders the same way COVID-19 did. You know, it went overseas and people started looking at their own countries and started looking at their own discrimination and institutional racism and things like that. So in many ways, I think the international community saw that aspect of the United States as, you know, bringing attention to something that's actually a global problem. On the other hand, you know, while a lot of countries are struggling to deal with COVID-19, I think the rest of the world is saying, yeah, but you're the United States. You should be doing a better job than the rest of us.
Yeah.
You know, you have more resources. And then just from the political side of it, you know, I don't know if embarrassment is necessarily the right word, but there's certainly not a lot of respect for how we handle our politics on the global level. And, of course, you know, other countries, there are plenty of other countries that are a mess and more of a mess. But I think everybody holds the United States to a higher standard, and you know, they should. That's appropriate. But we're not meeting that standard for the international community. So, you know, I think it's a tough time to be a U.S. citizen. There's no shortage of questions. There's no shortage of conversations that come up when I'm traveling around the world, which is something I do a lot less of right now, but as we all do, because of this. But, you know, we're in an interesting and tough spot. But I think, you know, we have a great opportunity now to move into different directions, into new directions, and you know, gain some respect of the international community once again.
I agree. And again, if you're just tuning into radio.com here in Boston, I'm Mike Mullaney. This is New England Lifestyles, and we're talking to Ravi Hasithing, who's an international keynote speaker, cultural catalyst, he calls himself, and I agree. And he's also an educator in the fact that he wants people to look at education a little different. We're talking about his book, which comes out on the 10th, but you can order it now through just about every place. The name of that book is Pivot, and let's talk about this book and why you thought it was important, because, you know, one of the things we've talked about is, you know, having to look at education in new ways. And it's not just about books. It's about, you know, almost like a global understanding. Tell me a little bit about the book and what you're trying to accomplish with it.
Yeah, well, the real important thing is to basically, you know, the sort of the secret of the book is that the only thing education has to do is teach a child how to learn. As long as we teach a child how to learn, then that child can pivot throughout the rest of their lives and constantly learn and adapt and adjust, be a lifelong learner, self-sufficient learner, all those types of things. So, you know, what was interesting is, of course, there's been a lot of talk about globalization and artificial intelligence and jobs being outsourced. You know, PricewaterhouseCoopers tells us that almost 40% of jobs are going to be outsourced in the next decade to technology. You know, where does that leave today's graduates and today's kindergartners when they graduate? You know, it's going to be a completely different landscape, a completely unpredictable one. And that's why it's so important to teach basically the one skill of how to learn so that every student and adult can continue to pivot throughout their lives. And, you know, with the technology, there's been so much conversation about reimagining education for so many years, and then COVID hit and everybody had to reimagine it overnight. And that was just such an interesting phenomenon that forced education itself to pivot. And technology that's supposed to be the great equalizer all of a sudden became the thing that was causing the most disparity, which was unexpected and ironic because, you know, there were families, well, let's look at it this way. There were middle class and lower class families that didn't have access to broadband internet. But then there were upper class families that had access to broadband internet, but they had so many devices that all of a sudden every house on the block is on, you know, 20 different devices each per house,
right,
during the day, that the bandwidth was slowing down and the kids couldn't, you know, get their Zoom conferences going with their teachers and things like that. So, you know, there was that aspect, but then, you know, there's, if you're not with broadband internet and you don't have access to it, and not every family's got three or four computers at home for their three or four kids to be online all day getting their education, it creates a tremendous amount of disparity that really wasn't well anticipated by the education industry.
That's true. I think it's interesting in the book is the fact that you when you talk about pivoting rather than changing, that's really an interesting concept. But we've seen pivoting and how you have to do it. I mean, it's not like everybody wanted to reinvent the way they approached the world, but we had to. And instead of having to change, we just had to pivot to the new technology as it existed. You know, suddenly...
But it's even more than that because, you know, change is very daunting. People are very intimidated by change. But what I talk about in the concept of pivot is that many of us actually do have pivot points, and those are our strengths. Those are our purposes, and you can pivot throughout life. You know, look, I went from being a musician to being a pilot to being a cultural diplomat for the U.S. Department of State. But my pivot point throughout all of that was actually music, even in aviation, because 49.7% of aviators play a musical instrument.
That's amazing.
I was helping aviation grow their pilot population because they couldn't attract the millennials. So we did it by setting up stages at airports and playing music and starting a Flying Musicians Association and all sorts of things. So, you know, when you find that passion, that strength, and that purpose, which for me, you know, the passion has been music, the strength has been communication, and the purpose has been to unite people. When you understand your pivot points, you can then move around in all different directions without shifting from those foundations.
You know, one of the things that I see that you really talk about, this is such an important point. Now, you know, we've mentioned it before, and I find it so fascinating but accurate. When you approach things, you can't emphasize the achievement. You know, getting the award isn't the key. The emphasizing is learning and always being curious and needing to discover more rather than shoot for, well, I'm going to go for being the number one music director in America. Well, fine. I won it multiple times. What does that mean? I mean, I have to learn more things. Tell me about this new system. Tell me about this new way to integrate metrics to really understand what people are into. You know what I mean? It's like, it's
right.
Not about achievement.
Yeah.
Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, so what I say in the book is, you know, that schools have to basically pivot themselves and they have to stop focusing on achievement and start focusing on learning because they really are two very different things. And, you know, from a metric standpoint, this really comes down to summative versus formative assessments in terms of how we assess students. And, you know, an easy way to sort of understand the difference between those, I like this metaphor, which is, you know, when a chef is cooking and he tastes the soup, that's formative assessment. But if he doesn't taste the soup and it just goes out to the customer, that's summative assessment. He no longer can make a change or an adjustment in order to produce a better result. So education has to do that too. They have to taste the soup. In other words, they have to evaluate the student not for the purpose of achievement, but for the purpose of figuring out how to teach that student better and how to get a better result in the end. So those formative assessments, which just can't come from a single letter grade or a multiple choice test, are something that involve a lot more creativity and insight from, you know, both in-person teachers and technology. Technology is a great tool in formative assessment as well. But we have to get away from this achievement-based concept, you know, where the goal of every kindergarten through 12th grade school is to prepare the student to go to college. And then the goal of every college is to prepare the student to go to graduate school. And then the goal of every graduate school is to, you know, hopefully at some point prepare the student for the workforce, which at that point maybe have changed a lot and may have been automated. So,
right.
You know, that's a long trajectory where I just think, you know, we've got to focus on learning. And when a kid says, yeah, but why do I need to learn calculus? I said, you probably don't, but you need to learn how to learn calculus so that you can go out and learn the things you need to learn, you know, later in life.
And that really is the key. And again, we're talking about the book, Pivot, Empowering Students Today to Succeed in an Unpredictable Tomorrow. And it's such a great point. You know, one of the things that you go to college assuming that they're going to teach you about everything, but what they really did is alter the way I think. You know what I mean? And that was just, that's really the thing. And you know, critical thinking is, there's been so many opportunities at critical thinking, especially this year, because there's been so much information. There's been so many memes. People are basing, you know, what they think about the election based on, you know, phony memes and stuff like that. Critical thinking is one of the most important things we can all do. You know what I mean? And relearning the way we think. Talk about the importance of that. I mean, it's like being a critic is one thing, but critical thinking is something entirely different and so vital to anyone's progression as a person.
Absolutely. You know, it's a combination of not just critical thinking, but curiosity. We have to keep curiosity and creativity involved in that so that one can then critically evaluate it. And in the book, I really talk a lot about educating the whole child. And a parent can't take their child and outsource its education entirely to a school system. Parents are very much the first educators. And they are the lifelong educators of any child as the child goes through school. So parents have to realize that they're in a partnership with school. They're not just outsourcing it to school. And the critical thinking component is something that has to happen in school, but also around the dinner table. And it's very important, those family dinners and that time where the parents can impart, you know, and provoke critical thinking at home, while schools also need to engage their students in debates. You know, there are not a lot of debate clubs or in-classroom debates going on like there used to be. And that's so important because that's where you learn critical thinking, you learn to listen, and you learn to respect an opposing point of view and perhaps even defend an opposing point of view, which forces critical thinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, that type of environment is really important. And, you know, that's just one of the things I talk about in the book, about the importance of debating, because it also teaches civil discourse, which is something that just doesn't exist in our social media world. And it's so important that we teach civil discourse. And even as adults, you know, we don't have a particularly good handle on that. So a lot of the book also emphasizes the importance of teaching by example. We simply have to, as I quote often in the book from Gandhi, we have to be the change. Can't just talk about it, can't just teach it. We actually have to be it.
And again, you know, as we talk today, I want to encourage everyone to go to the website that Ravi has, because there's a lot of stuff there. It is raviunites.com, and you can find the information about the book. But you can also find a lot about just, you know, the projects you do, you know, your schools, songwriting safaris. It's interesting how, you know, we really have become international, and so much of, you know, what the Black Lives Matter push was really kind of trying to get out of your own head and understand, you know, show more empathy and understand the perspectives. Why do the people feel this way? Rather than just say, well, you know, I don't believe that, you know, the police are wrong in this situation. It's not about that. It's about trying to understand their perspectives and how, just because you don't feel racism, for example, I always thought that there was no racism because I was a white guy and I didn't see it. And it's until I met my wife, who's a South Vietnamese, you know, a Vietnamese refugee, I didn't understand what she meant by day-to-day, discrimination. It really opened my eyes. And you have to understand that you can't think of what your perspective is. Your perspective is yours, but it really doesn't impact the rest of the world. And integrating this new approach to the world in so many different perspectives, because it has become a global community, there's so much to be learned if you open your perspectives. And, you know, the education process is about that. It's not just being what you see. You know, it's the same idea of, you know, if you only judge world hunger based on whether or not there's food on your plate, you're really not understanding the big picture.
Well, exactly. You know, and you're talking about something that I talk about a lot, not just in my keynotes, but in the book and just in general conversation, which is cultural competence. And cultural competence to me is not just about, you know, what somebody doing on the other side of the world. It's cultural competence is also understanding a baby boomer versus a millennial.
Yeah.
you know, that's cultural competence. Cultural competence is understanding a privileged person from somebody that's on welfare. That's cultural competence, because I believe that culture really is our beliefs, behaviors, and values. And what informs our beliefs, behaviors, and values is where we're from, when we were born, and what our socioeconomic profile is. And so, you know, it's really important to become culturally competent to understand those aspects about oneself, because that's what creates our own implicit biases. Implicit bias is something, you know, that everybody sort of talks about as a very negative thing. And you'll never defeat your implicit biases, and you shouldn't. It's part of human nature.
Yeah.
But you got to recognize them. You have to start to know, okay, well, this is why, you know, I'm choosing one cashier in the line over another. You know, you may not realize that you do that when you're at the grocery store, but you might, because you have some kind of implicit bias. And then you know, once you recognize that, then you can sort of actively work against it and make sure that if you're hiring somebody to work for you, that you're not letting that aspect of your own personality influence the merit of that person that's applying for a job, for example. If we don't address those things, then institutional racism continues as the street racism.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, as I look at everything and I see there's so much to talk about in the book, because it really reflects what you're all about. But, you know, the idea that, you know, everyone's so different around the world, but then if you put a ball with a bunch of people who don't speak a common language, as soon as the ball drops in front of them, they can play, because they all understand that that's something you could do together. Music is that same way, where you've gone throughout the world and united folks through music and collaborations between groups that on paper should never be collaborating. But there are so many little things that bring us together, and we have to find more of those things.
Yeah, you know, I've got it in the book. I've laid it out, you know, with a lot of these stories, and then at the end of each chapter has some suggested pivots that are based on the things that I've discovered, both through research and empirically. And then there's some photos. And, you know, some of those photos that I have in there are Christians, Muslims, and Buddhists writing songs together. Yeah. Or an Iraqi and Kurd giving, high five to each other after writing a song. And, you know, there's all sorts of cool things that just happen when you put people in an environment where they're being creative together. They become genuinely curious about each other. And, you know, the Ravi Knight School Network that I have too, which is 150 schools around the world that we do real-time audio video interactions between classrooms. And I usually host them. And it's just amazing, you know, Mike, because I set these things up and then I just kind of sit back and watch it all happen magically on their own, because kids are genuinely curious. And if we can bring them all together so that they can bond naturally before we teach them how to hate each other, you know, that would be a really good thing.
Yeah.
I think we, you know, world peace becomes maybe possible under those circumstances.
Let me ask you this. And obviously, this is one of those funny questions, but, you know, you were, you're back in, you know, you live in, where do you live, Virginia?
Yeah, Central Virginia, near Charlottesville, actually.
Right. So, so near one of those.
Yeah, right in the center of it all.
Yeah. But, I mean, when you were out of the United States for those 6 months, what are some of the things that you miss when you're outside of a country like this? Because obviously we have a lot of challenges, but there's certain things that are very unique to the United States that you miss when you're out for 6 months.
Yeah,
what are some of those things?
Absolutely. That's, you know, the United States is just, it's comfortable, it's convenient. Things tend to work. There is, you know, there's corruption, of course, on high levels. But there isn't the kind of street corruption that exists in many other parts of the world, India, Chile, places like that. People are generally honest. People are genuinely kind. here. You know, and I feel that, you know, I see the positive and the negative as soon as I get back to the airport, you know, in the United States, if I land at whatever, Chicago, Miami, New York, it doesn't matter. You recognize that there are just certain things that are innate in the way an American citizen or somebody that just lives here feels. I mean, it's interesting, as I say that, I was just thinking, you know, well, sometimes landing in New York is a different experience than landing, you know, in Charlotte, North Carolina or something, because that Southern hospitality that's uniquely, you know, American too, is just something that makes you feel like, wow, you've come home. You know, somebody loves you and somebody's calling you darling. And, you know, there's just something.
Yeah, New York doesn't always do that.
Yeah, New York doesn't always do that. They call you something else sometimes. Yeah. But.
Hey, buddy.
And I say that, you know, I live in the South, and before, I live in Virginia now. Before that, I lived in New Orleans and Louisiana. But I grew up in Connecticut, so,
right,
you know, I'm a Yankee. So.
For sure. Well, again, the book is out this week on the 10th, but you can order it now through Amazon. Hardcover, it comes in an ebook form. Again, the name of the book is Pivot, Empowering Students Today to Succeed in an Unpredictable Tomorrow. But again, the book has a lot of, I would imagine, through all of our conversations, it's so much provocative conversation, and it's simple, back to basics, and it's really eye-opening on a simple level, which I guess is a way of putting it. You talk about things that should make sense, but you don't always think about them.
Yeah, you know, well, a lot of times we just need to have it there in black and white for us to really try to evaluate and bring it to the surface again. You know, it's sometimes it's stuff we know, but we need to hear it. And we need to hear it through a slightly different lens when this is what I really tried to accomplish in the book, is to make sure that there are actionable takeaways, things that people can clearly implement, you know, immediately at home, in school, and at work, in order to try to achieve some of these pivots that will not only strengthen themselves, but strengthen their community, and especially for teachers, that will strengthen their classrooms and their students.
Well, I always appreciate our time. Great catching up with you, my friend, Ravi. Again, the website, raviunites.com. You can get everything you need there. It is always great to catch up with you, my friend.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.